are back with episode 670 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and no, I will not be sneaking off to try and run a Critical Myth TV ad anytime soon.
And I'm really glad that that's not the case. I mean, I honestly don't want you to be trying that anytime soon either. We are once again a duo. Gary unfortunately could not be here, and Bronstone, of course, is still kind of wrapping up some things on the personal end. So we are going to be getting into this week's episodic discussion. But before we do any of that, Edmund, if you could please.
Yes, our policy here is to talk about whatever we feel like talking about these episodes, and that means if you haven't seen them, you will be spoiled. So be ready with that fast forward as necessary.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And we are going to be starting off, as is traditional, with the bottom three episodes of the week. Now, this is an interesting week, I have to say. Despite the fact that there's, 19 episodes that we're covering, this has to be one of the more... I don't even know what to say. It's not like mediocre weeks, but it's a very small range. It only goes from 6.5 to 8.5. We don't have anything up in the nines like we've had of late. So this one, yeah, we've got a bottom three that starts off at 7.25 with Colony, Season 1, Episode 7, Broussard. Will hunts the Resistance, bringing him closer to learning his wife's secret. Katie feels cut off from her family and her cell, and Maddie is caught up in Green Zone intrigue. Yes, and this one, I don't know. I made one note about this episode, and I just said this show is trying really hard. It is. Yeah, it's trying.
It's trying, yeah.
It's just not doing much. It's just really trying. But it throws so much at the screen, and it just doesn't gel. Mm-hmm. It's just not gelling. And it's unfortunate, because there are some things in this series that are pretty good. And there are moments that actually work, and then there's just the stuff in between.
Mm-hmm. And it's certainly a case of some very good performers. I mean, who are doing making a yeoman's effort with the material they've been given. But a concept. I mean, in terms of whatever this invasion is, the whole idea of collaborating and resisting and building cells, there's certainly a wealth of potential in this material, but unfortunately it's not really living up to certainly some of the classics in this genre. I mean, Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Heinlein about the hidden rebellion on the moon is what immediately comes to mind as the sort of thing that they should be trying to emulate, and but it just isn't really doing it at this point.
No, unfortunately, it's not. So. Moving on then to our number two, or our second of the bottom three. And Edmund, why don't you take this one?
Yes, well, I guess I will have to, since I was the only one keeping up with Elementary this week. This is Season 4, Episode 14, Who is That Masked Man? The identity of Sherlock's mother is revealed, and his strained relationship with Moreland reaches a breaking point. Meanwhile, an elderly woman emerges as the prime suspect in the murders of three gang members. And I gave this a 7, and unfortunately this, after a couple of better episodes, this was Elementary really sliding back into a very conventional case of the week. Basically, there was really nothing going on in this investigation that required any brilliant deductive reasoning from Sherlock. It was really just following the evidence and another of those cases where you didn't really see why Sherlock and Joe needed to be along. The police probably could have figured this all out on their own. Meanwhile, at with Moreland, with John Noble as Sherlock's father, they were continuing to bring out more of the backstory, and even there it wasn't sort of any shattering revelations. Basically, I mean, when they're talking about his mother's identity being revealed, it wasn't really that so much as just getting some of the background for how the breakup occurred, and just this little tidbit that she had her own addiction issues, which is not surprising given the way it can be there can be some genetics involved in addiction. So it was the show continuing its do its realistic take on addiction issues, but none of it was really all that compelling. So just once again, dead average, and with as I was just saying with Colony, I mean, and as has often been the case with this series, some great actors just doing what they can with the material, but Elementary sort of backsliding into not quite mediocrity, but nothing special.
Yeah, it sounds like. All right, that means that we can go to our bottom show for the week, and unfortunately, this is a show that is no stranger to the bottom in recent years, but had been elevating quite a bit. But geez, considering the central conceit of this episode, I'm not surprised it is at the bottom. Coming in at 6.5, we have Supernatural Season 11, Episode 15, Beyond the Mat. Sam and Dean attend a wrestling match to relive one of their fondest memories, but when a wrestler turns up dead, they suspect foul play. Yeah, I did not like this much at all. I was kind of disappointed, and I understand. There's 17, or not 17, 11 seasons.
It just feels like that sometimes.
Sometimes. There are 11 seasons into the show. I mean, this is the longest running show on the CW. I mean, going well back before the CW existed. And I understand that they are trying to find things about the Winchester brothers that we don't know. But there was no hint whatsoever that they were into wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of those things where it was so out of left field that Dean would be such a diehard wrestling fan that I thought that it was an episode that was written by my least favorite duo of recent years. But no, that wasn't the case at all. So that's telling me that it's starting to spread amongst the other writers and the writing staff, this penchant for just pulling people of note out of nowhere as if we were supposed to know that they were important to Sam or Dean all this while. And that's really such a basic writing trope, bad writing trope, that, it's unfortunate to see it pop its ugly head up again. So.
Yeah, I mean, and especially, I mean, in with a little tweaking, I think the problem was more making Dean such a huge fan, since we certainly didn't, hadn't had him, watching some WWE in the background, or at least making mention of wrestlers along the way, and I think if they just made it, no, this is something that that their dad had taken them to, but they weren't necessarily that into it. It could have helped it considerably. I agree. The actual case really wasn't that good. And for me, it was Crowley finally getting out of the doghouse reemerging was what made the episode a little bit more enjoyable for me.
That was at least a highlight of the episode, but for me, it was just too little too late.
Yeah.
So, yeah, unfortunately, Supernatural, once again, winding up down at the bottom after really doing very well for the last, most of the season up till now. So I'm hoping that this is just an aberration, right? We're not going to go down into bestiality type of topics anytime soon, hopefully.
Yes.
Hopefully.
We can only hope. Absolutely.
We can definitely only hope. But all right, we're going to then go ahead and move to the top three for the week. And all of these came in at 8.5. So above average, but again, not into the lofty type of 9-ish range. There were technically 4 shows that came in at 8.5 this week, but just kind of arranged them as I believe they would have gone. I'm sure Gary would have given our number 3 show a good score and probably would have put it up in number 1, but too bad. He's not here. So it's going to wind up in our number 3 slot, and that is Star Wars Rebels Season 2, Episode 17, The Honorable Ones, a failed Imperial ambush strands Zeb and Agent Kallus on an isolated ice planet where they must work together to survive. And I give this one an 8.5. As I said, I think it had a lot of nice continuity references, and it's always fun to have one of those, you know, allies of convenience or strange bedfellows type of stories. This one reminded me vaguely of Enemy Mine, vaguely because it wasn't nearly as deep, but it certainly had an interesting interaction between a rebel and an imperial trying to survive and just basically struggling with similarities and differences of their philosophies, and maybe finding that they're not so far apart as they would have imagined. But a good story. I'm sure, like I said, that Gary would have really scored this one high. Just it's doing extremely well in this latter half of the second season. That brings us to our number two show, which, again, also coming in at 8.5, Black Sails, Season 3, Episode 6, 24. Teach is challenged by Flint. Rogers makes an arrest. Maddie helps Silver. Rackham charts a new course. And yes, this again, I'll just say for me, the real highlight of this episode was the duel between Flint and Teach.
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
Yes, and didn't end exactly the way that I expected, although I suppose I should have thought of it that way, considering Flint is more the main character. But even me saying that, it doesn't end the way that you think just from me saying that much. There's a little more complication to it than that. But Flint's whole thing of kind of pulling together this alliance with the Maroons and everything else is, as things are getting more contested in Nassau, Flint's getting ready to make his own bid for power. And I'm intrigued by that.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, I mean, in addition to the duel, which was very well done, and felt very realistic to the time as well. I mean, I don't think I've seen a duel playing out that felt quite so authentic since Barry Lyndon, actually. But back in in Nassau, I really enjoyed the duel of wits going on with Rackham and his whole little deception of writing the letter to Anne, but just knowing full well, even though he was saying what the governor wanted him to say, knowing exactly how Anne was going to interpret it, in fact, of course, not turn herself and the money in, which is certainly complicating life for our current governor, and it does look like they are definitely heading towards quite a climactic showdown in Nassau, especially if the Spanish do react as badly as we all assume they're going to the loss of a significant part of their riches. Basically, I felt like this is a case where it's an 8.5 that we both gave it, but that was more just because they are still kind of just doing the setup to that what promises to be that huge battle to conclude this season, one of those classic cases of scoring it with room for it to improve, but it was certainly an extremely enjoyable 8.5.
All right, and that brings us to our number one show for the week, and Edmund, this is going to be you again.
Absolutely. This is Better Call Saul, Season 2, Episode 3, Amarillo. Jimmy's client outreach efforts thrive as he exhibits new heights of showmanship. Meanwhile, Mike is perplexed by daughter-in-law Stacy's troubling news. And this was, no surprise, Jimmy getting into almost immediate trouble while at the same time being very successful and thinking outside the box of this rather conventional law firm that he's landed himself in or at, and it's one of those cases of you see him digging the hole for himself, as he puts together this TV commercial as a way of a rather brilliant way of getting to all of these residents of these nursing homes that they are trying to reach for this lawsuit, very cannily scheduling the commercial to run at the first ad at the very beginning of the first ad break of Murder, She Wrote, which naturally he had noticed how everybody in the nursing home is always watching it at 3 o'clock in the afternoon when it runs, he of course does it on his own say so, doesn't get permission, the classic it's better to ask forgiveness than ask permission, the episode ends with it completely blowing up in his face. We will have to wait until next week to see just how bad the fallout is. Just a very, very nice and entertaining episode again. Meanwhile, with Jonathan Banks, just continuing to just kill it as Mike. The nonverbal acting that he does in this show is just extraordinary. He's trying to do the best for his daughter-in-law and young grandchild. He's starting to get him pulled into these deeper and deeper into these criminal elements that of course he will have fully given into by the time you actually get to Breaking Bad, but you are seeing him starting to slide down that slippery slope, in both cases, but both of our main characters, they are lurching towards the fates that we know they're going to have, but it's still being done in a wonderfully written and fabulously acted fashion.
Well, that sounds like it deserves to be at the top of the list then.
Yes, absolutely.
So there you go. All right. That means that we are going to go ahead and get into the mid-ground of this particular week. And it makes sense then that we'll go ahead and talk about the other show that could have been in the top three, considering it was in a tie. And that would be The Magician, Season 1, Episode 7, The Mayakovsky Circumstances. Mayakovsky, I believe it is, and an uncompromising professor pushes boundaries both in magic and in the personal lives of his first-year students. Meanwhile, Julia must decide whether she's ready to accept help and what that means for her future as a magician. And I gave this one an 8.5. I thought there was some great character progression in this episode, and even better, what made this really hilarious is that the episodes are filmed ostensibly for the DVDs or for other outlets that don't typically censor language. And I guess the censors at Sci-Fi forgot about that. And there were several, easily a dozen instances in the first 40 minutes of this show where F-bombs were dropping left and right.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, big time. And I was watching the my DVR version, so it was the one from Sci-Fi. It wasn't like, I got it through other means. So it was good to see the show as it was meant to be heard. it flows a lot better when you just kind of let the language go, but it is meant to be a much more I wouldn't say necessarily adult. They don't get into too much of that material, although obviously there's a lot of sexuality. There's a lot of language, clearly. So it is meant for a more adult audience or at least mature audience. And what's funny is just that, yeah, I don't know if Sci-Fi heard anything about it or not. I imagine that they would have from certain people, because it was just not hidden at all. And it was so obvious that when they finally did start to bleep it out, it felt unnatural by that point, because you were used to hearing the language the way it should have been. So, it was notable for that, but it was also a really good episode. I'm really enjoying this series. It does strike me as kind of grad school in the Harry Potter universe almost. All those things, like I said, that are hinted at and implied in the later novels in terms of the way that some magic can be misused. It kind of gets explored more here, but it's also just a darker magic type of world. There are much greater consequences for things. And I like the way that the characters and their relationships are building on this show. It's really working out very well. So definitely deserves to be in a tie with the top three. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and that's wild about the language, because there has been that thing of at least on basic cable where the S word is getting more permitted. It's usually you seem to be allowed one or two instances an hour, but certainly F-bombs are not supposed to be on regular TV, and I hope they don't get into too much trouble with the FCC about that.
Yeah, I really hope that they don't either, because I really found it refreshing to not have to worry about that. And just, I don't know, maybe things are getting a little more, what's the word I'm looking for? A little more liberal.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the FCC we're talking about. Oh, my kid.
Yeah. Although I do have one question. What time of night does The Magicians air? Do you recall?
I don't recall. It's either 9 or 10.
Okay. So yeah, cause that there may be a little bit of that going on as well. You know, where there always used to be that that thing of you know, the more serious dramas, you know, at 10 o'clock were allowed a little more latitude in the past. So there may be something like that starting to happen as well, where when
it's possible,
you know,
yeah,
when it's later at night, you can get away with a little bit more.
Mm. Let's see here. Okay, I know we already talked about Supernatural, but somebody just sent me a link that there is going to be, in September, the official Supernatural coloring book. I hope you have a lot of black for the demonic stuff. That's all I can say.
Yeah, well, yeah, well, I was going to say, you know, yeah, it's, you know, with the two colored pencils, black and red.
That's right. That's all you need. And just lace it with a bunch of self-hatred and daddy issues.
Yes.
Lots and lots of daddy issues. Anywho, getting back to the episodic discussion. Sorry, that was just hilarious that exists. Supergirl, Season 1, Episode 15, Solitude. Supergirl does battle with a living supercomputer named Indigo, who has a connection to Kara's past. In order to defeat this dangerous being, a trip to Superman's Fortress of Solitude proves necessary. Meanwhile, James and Lucy reach a crossroads in their relationship. And this episode came in at an 8.38. Gary actually left us some comments here. He says, honestly, it deserves a 10 for that sweet view of the Legion flight ring. Oh, Gary.
Of course.
Oh, and the Fortress of Solitude with Key? Pinch me, I must be dreaming. He wrote that. I'm just pointing this out. He says, I rewatched that part at least 4 times so far.
So far, yes.
So far. That being said, we got introduced to a new villain with some decidedly non-Kryptonian powers that are pretty cool. The Miso-Silo scenes were great. As far as our cast goes, Alex revealing her secret killing of Astro was a relief, both from the point of Kara's forgiveness and that the secret wouldn't keep dragging on for more episodes. I would have been fine with James going back with Lucy. Her departure and the ramp-up to Kara-James relationship leaves me worried. I enjoyed the Lucy character and had hoped to see her used more often. Supergirl is flying high, and I can't wait to see where she goes next. Honestly, I could flesh this out into an actual review at this point.
Yes.
Well done, Gary, who gave this one a 9, which was pretty much the high score for the week. For me, I just have to say that this was pretty impressively done for a TV budget. And yeah, I like the fact that the relationships are being kind of moved forward and progressed. How about you, Edmund?
Yeah, definitely. I certainly agree with Gary. I was getting tired of the whole keeping the secret. You know, that was just way too much of a TV trope, and it's one of those tropes that really gets overused and does tend to drag a show down. It just seems in general that it's always used in this thing of two characters who are very close and probably you know, pretty understanding of each other. So you know, yeah. You know, people who were you may get initially mad, but you are going to forgive and move on, which is, of course, what actually happened. Yeah, the villain, aside from the you know, especially when she started stretching her arms to do the double missile silos and given her coloring, not being the expert in the DC universe that Gary is, I was really starting to wonder that you know, was this sort of a DC knockoff of Mystique, or was Mystique a Marvel knockoff of her, on the other relationship front, I was actually I was rather surprised at how well they handled the Lucy James breakup. Seemed to have a much more mature feel than those things usually do, which then made the whole Siobhan, the evil assistant, getting together with Wynn just felt in incredibly clumsy in comparison. Didn't really seem necessary either. You know, perhaps this is setting up something else for down the road. But this was one of those cases where even though it you know, no, it's not on the CW with its you know, more often younger adult focus. But it did sort of remind me of some of those clunky relationship issues from those early days of Arrow. You know, given the fact it's the same team, it was a bit of a shame to see that resurfacing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Let's see here. Moving on then to the next one on the list, we have The Walking Dead, Season 6, Episode 11, Knots Untie. After Rick comes to the realization that Alexandria might not be as safe as he thought, decisions must be made about where to go. And this one came in at an average of 8.25. Flacco Jones over at VogNetwork.com says, "Ha, glad you waited until the summary at the end to mention that love triangle plot. It was definitely a head-scratcher in an episode that was really focused and well-made otherwise. Love the politics going on and the idea that there are communities scattered all over that have little more to them than wherever Team Grimes is and whoever they're up against." Okay, and Gary came in with with the low score for this week. He says, "This was an okay episode. I'd really hoped for more variation from the source material. Jesus' group was really less impressive, other than food supplies, than I had hoped. I love how Rick is so proactive against Negan, not wanting to ever have any more sneak attacks against his people." Yeah. I definitely feel like this... I see Gary's point that this was really very, very similar to the source material. It was almost a straight-up adaptation of the exact same moments from the comic. That's worrisome in the fact that it could get a little predictable throughout the rest of the season, depending on whether or not you've read the comic. And also worrisome from the point of view that if they do adhere to the comic, some bad things are really, really bad things are going to happen. So I'm hoping that there is some variation so that everyone is surprised. I don't want to go into the finale and the stretch of episodes leading into it knowing exactly what's going to happen. That's not at all what I want. How about you, Edmund? What were your thoughts on this particular episode?
Yeah, I thought that in terms of the situation and the sort of the action sequences and the tension was quite well done. But for me, I mean, not being the Walking Dead neophyte, or at least the one who hasn't read the comics, it did feel to me that we're sort of retreading things of coming across. Yet another place that sort of magically kept itself together. Except this time, it was it's a sort of a variation of Alexandria, but with a guy who thinks he's the governor, but is really just a third rate imitation of him. And certainly, it certainly worked in terms of being a community that Negan could just push around. Certainly, even without all of the hints and expectations that I've been hearing about Negan, it definitely had that sense of Rick and the group. Maybe getting a little overconfident and sure of their abilities. I mean, yes, they have managed to get through all of these meetings with opponents and come out the other side and feel stronger for it. It did certainly have a feel of the pride going before the fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is exactly the way that it feels, right? I mean, it makes perfect sense that there's other communities. This is a more populated part of the country. There's been hints and allegations that there are others out there, and now we know that there are. And what I think Rick and his little friends are forgetting here on Team Grimes is that if all these other little communities exist and they're all bending their knee to Negan and the Saviors, maybe you might want to do some recon first before offering up your people as an army to take them out. I mean, they do say that Negan, at least one group, was 20 people, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean that it's the whole bit of the Saviors. So they do get some warning that they might want to pay a little attention. But they're cocky. They're arrogant. They feel like, hey, we got through the herd. We got through the wolves. We should be okay, right? It definitely feels like they're being set up for some consequences for, quote unquote, being proactive. I don't know. Considering the fact that they're still trying to trade to get some kind of supplies, they might want to tread lightly. Because how do they know that what they're being told is true either? I mean, that the whole instance with somebody coming in and stabbing the leader of the community because they don't feel like they have any other option but to do what Negan says, that should probably be an indication that bad things are on the horizon.
You would think, yes.
You would think, but maybe not. I guess Rick and Daryl have had it too easy. they've all had it too easy. So, yes, we'll find out what's going to happen there relatively soon, I would think. All right, that means that we can move on to Agent Carter, Season 2, Episode 10, Hollywood Ending. The Season 2 finale finds everyone facing a mission they may not come back from as Peggy urges Howard Stark to eliminate Zero Matter. Yes, and this is the... This comes in also at an 8.25. And Gary says here, it was a great ending for the season/series. Where did it go? There it is. The cast came back strong with the exception of Howard Stark, who unfortunately has been a bit of a third wheel for the second season. I wish they had utilized the character more, but given they hadn't, he really deserved no place in the finale. Whitney's loss of Zero Matter was well executed, including the awesome hover car scene. I particularly enjoyed the Jarvis-Peggy scenes in better defining their relationship with each other. I wish they had tightened up this season a bit more and had less filler, but it has been a good season. Rumors are that renewal won't happen for Agent Carter, and that's sad. I would love to see how the SSR finally becomes S.H.I.E.L.D. We need a season in San Francisco to play up Hydra's historical Asian side. Good point there at the end.
Absolutely.
Yes, yeah, why not? Just have Peggy go from city to city. I thought it was actually a pretty solid ending, and I agree. I don't want this to be the end of the adventure. I want it to keep going. But I also understand that the season finale was also a series low when it comes to ratings. So it's really hard. We were shocked when it came back for season two.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard for me to imagine that they're going to bring it back for season three, especially when they have another option to slot in between the two halves of season four of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, I know for my part, I gave it a little bit less than you and Henry over on the website, but just at an 8. I definitely agree with Gary that Howard coming back in and being such a huge part of the planning and execution felt shoehorned in and kind of unnecessary. I mean, they'd done a great job of sort of building up this team and certainly with Jarvis taking on more responsibility and also realizing exactly where his shortcomings might be with the help of his beloved wife I really didn't see why Howard needed to be there he just felt out of step with the rest of the team tonally as well but that aside, I mean, I certainly have very much enjoyed the series. That actual finale itself, I thought parts of it were well done, parts of it felt just a little sort of static and stagey, but I realized later after I'd written out my own notes that also was kind of in keeping with what I talked about, how they really sort of did a great job of capturing the feel of those old Saturday morning serials, where those climactic battles, could sometimes be a little static. So it was actually in keeping with the period they were evoking, I will certainly be sorry to see it go if that is in fact the case.
Yeah, I don't see it being resurrected, unfortunately. All right, that means bring us to the next show, which is, Vikings, Season 4, Episode 2, Kill the Queen. Ragnar and Floki clash in Kattegat as Rollo woos his new bride in Paris. Also, the wilderness tests Bjorn's survival skills, and King Ecbert enlists his son to rescue Queen Gwynthryth. So, yeah, a lot going on in this particular episode. A lot of big action sequences, in fact, and it came in at an average of 8. Just so much going on. They've clearly increased the budget. It's almost too much, but it's a lot of setup. And as the season progresses, I'm sure that certain events and certain storylines are going to kind of streamline and become a little bit more familiar. But they are definitely having fun with the fact that they've got a lot more room to maneuver, a lot more episodes this season. Vikings is that little show that could. I almost thought after the first season that it was a kind of a DOA type of show, and it has turned into a bit of a phenomenon, which I think is amazing. All right, that brings us to The 100, Season 3, Episode 6, Bitter Harvest. Clark is torn between vengeance and mercy. Meanwhile, Kane and Octavia work together to prevent a disaster, and Abby continues to worry about Raven. And this also came in at an average of 8. Edmund, what would you say about this one in particular?
Well, I'm really enjoying the way they are playing out these. I mean, all these varied storylines. I mean, you know, that whole CW's Game of Thrones reference from earlier in the season. I mean, just really being borne out. It's also intriguing me how they are managing to do it on a couple of different fronts. I mean, where you've got the conflicts with the grounders and between the grounders, which is sort of the more grounded, more sort of savage part of the story. But now with Thelonious back and this whole sort of futuristic virtual world that's been introduced with the City of Light and the mysteries that are still playing out about exactly what the motivations are with that, and the way they started pushing that a little bit further with Raven joining the inhabitants of the City of Light, and the wonders it did in healing her leg or making it easier for her to deal with her leg. This show just continues to add this depth to its world building, which I'm really very much enjoying. And of course, since I haven't mentioned Person of Interest yet, it is just always nice to get my little pretend Zoe fix Paige Turco continues to possibly enter into a relationship with Kane, who's no Reese, but he'll do in a pinch.
Yeah, a little bit different there. Certainly. The 100 still just knocking it out of the park. Really a strong season so far, I have to say. Next on the list, The Vampire Diaries, Season 7, Episode 14, Moonlight on the Bayou. Stefan visits New Orleans to lure vampire hunter Raina Cruz away from his friends in Mystic Falls. In the Big Easy, Stefan meets Klaus Michelson. They've known each other for a while. Why does it sound like they've met for the first time? Anyway, who becomes suspicious of his old friend's unexpected arrival. Meanwhile, Enzo approaches Damon and Bonnie with a plan that could protect Stefan from Raina, and Alaric decides to leave for Dallas with the twins, and Caroline offers to accompany them on the trip. And this one came in at an 8, largely because of the crossover with the originals. That's always going to make things better right now. It really just did a great job of demonstrating why The Vampire Diaries is weak, and the spinoff is really the stronger of the two shows, and has been since pretty much it premiered. Speaking of the originals, Season 3, Episode 14, A Streetcar Named Desire. The threat of the prophecy looms over Klaus and Elijah, who find themselves rendered useless inside a magical trap, while Aya and the Strix's coven of witches move forward with a risky spell that could take one of them down for good. Elsewhere, Freya leads the charge to get her brothers back and enlists the help of Marcel, Haley, and Stefan Salvatore, whose unexpected arrival may be the key to their survival. Maybe. Not as much as one would think, but that's okay. It was a crossover this week, between these two episodes. And like I said, everything that was involved with New Orleans and the originals made everything better, and everything that was kind of still stuck back within Mystic Falls was just blah. I really feel like, unfortunately, based on the ratings and the fact that they've now been kind of pushed over onto Friday night, both these shows are probably going to be ending this year, so it will be the end of the story for both of them. But that's my prediction anyway. If it were up to me, the originals would keep going, but apparently the ratings aren't so good for either show at this point. So it was a good run for both shows. So there we are. In a similar vein, we have Bitten, Season 3, Episode 3, Right Behind You. More of Roman soldiers descend on Bear Valley as Elena struggles to convince Jeremy to protect her blood family against the Russian Alpha, who's on a quest to kill Sasha. Meanwhile, Nick investigates what Roman and his werewolves have planned. I also give this one an 8. I feel like the family drama is heating up. A lot of the loose threads over the course of the series are starting to get tied together, which makes sense considering that this is supposed to be the final season. So, yes. Speaking of final seasons, we have Lost Girl, Season 5, Episode 13, Family Portrait. Beau searches for truth when confronted with conflicting versions of her past. And surprisingly, this episode got an 8. Largely because things finally happened. Edmund,
yeah,
you gave it an 8 too.
Yeah. So. Oh, yeah. I mean, well, I mean, the fact that we were getting back to actually focusing on our core group of characters, and even you know, Aoife, you know, her Beau's mother reappearing, and also just some straight up you know, good family conflict. I mean, all these conflicting stories about how sort of Beau came to be, and that nice little seeds of doubt being planted about whether she in fact had been following the you know, giving her loyalty to the right side of the family with Trick, you know, but of course then all leading to you know, it is Eric Roberts we're talking about, so you know, yes, of course he did in the end reveal himself to be as evil as assumed up until now, and this is a case of an episode title that you know, actually does basically become the climax of the episode, and I thought was quite effective and as well as distressing, of course. I mean, we're coming to the end of the series, and that given this the way the story's gone over the years, it's no surprise that that also means we are coming to the end of some of our characters too.
Mm-hmm. Which is one of those things, like I said, is actually making things a little bit more interesting finally. But we'll see if it can continue to have this level of energy as we drive towards the close.
Yes.
Indeed. All right. Let's see here. Next on the list is Arrow, Season 4, Episode 15, Taken. Oliver enlists Vixen's help to battle Dark. She uses her magical ability to summon animal powers and gets a lock on Dark's location. Meanwhile, Thea has a heart-to-heart talk with Malcolm. And this episode came in at an average of 7.83. Nadim gave it an 8, saying, "While it was definitely a treat to meet Vixen, a questionable ending and endless exposition made this a less than stellar hour. I so wish Arrow would regain its mojo." Indeed. And I really have to say, once again, the flashbacks are the biggest thing holding everything back. It's great to see that there are consequences for Oliver and all this deception around William and how that messes up his relationship with Felicity. But, I mean, the ending really was dodgy. She's walking again just in time to walk out the door. Really?
Yeah.
Isn't that a little symbolic or something? I don't know. There's a word for it. I don't know what it is, but crappy. I don't know.
I think convenient might be the one.
Yeah, there you go. Convenient. That's the word I was looking for. Sure.
But yeah, no, I mean, I certainly agree with the, you know, the flashbacks. I mean, this, you know, I thought, initially, especially with Constantine being brought in and the fact that you know, that there is the more supernatural bent, with Dark and obviously Vixen's appearance, this time, that, the flashbacks were going to add to some of that supernatural tone, which they might be, but it's just taking so long for anything to happen. You know, and especially this time where it's like, yes, okay, they have a portal open, and then yeah, we just get to a cavern and we don't even know what's in it yet. So yeah, it's just really hard to see what they are supposed to be adding to the show. And I've got to say, it I was kind of glad to see Dark finally defeated, because to my mind hasn't quite lived up to some of our previous big bads, you know, like certainly Deathstroke or Malcolm Merlyn, who was of course still around, you know, and I mean, I would kind of like to see Mr. Barrowman maybe move back into that more central role of as antagonist, and certainly with the way things are going with him and Thea, perhaps that wish will come true.
It's possible, I suppose. All right, let's see here. We are going to then go ahead and talk about Sleepy Hollow, Season 3, Episode 12, Sins of the Father. Jenny confronts her father, which dredges up some unsavory family history. Meanwhile, Atticus Nevins returns to Sleepy Hollow and presents the FBI with a dangerous set of challenges. I give this one a 7.5. It, quite frankly, wasn't all that memorable because I read that description and I honestly don't remember much of that at all. So it was a 7.5. I mean, there were some good moments, certainly, but I think the biggest thing was that Abby is starting to have some issues from her return from the dimension that she was sent by Pandora.
Purgatory or whatever it was, yes.
Yeah, that's what I say. I wanted to say Purgatory, but then I yes. I don't know.
No, that was that other show where people yeah. get sent off to for years or more.
Yes. So we shall see if the season can kind of, I don't know, that episode for whatever reason just didn't really stick. And surprisingly, we still have now, finally, at the bottom of our list here, not in the bottom three, but pretty close, Legends of Tomorrow, Season 1, Episode 6, Star City 2046. A malfunction sends the Wave Rider crashing into 2046 Star City, and the heroes face a startling version of their own future where they never stop Savage and never return home. The city is in ruins and overrun by criminals, which thrills Rory, but Sarah is despondent over the destruction of her home and stunned when she learns what happened to her old friend, Oliver Queen. Mm-hmm. This one coming in at an average of 7.38. Nadim giving it a 6.5, saying this should have been the show's defining hour thus far, but it was disappointing on almost every level. Gary, on the other hand, gave it an 8, saying I enjoyed this foray into the future DCW, and I hope they don't make a habit of it. It feels like stunt casting. It finally felt like the team is coming together, which is a good thing. I'm still concerned how they will change history. I would love to see some decisive victory against Savage that makes him start from scratch. Comic book references. Green Arrow's future arm loss was written in the original Dark Knight Returns comic back in 86. It was always implied but never confirmed that Superman caused it.
Ooh.
Yes. But very different opinions there, almost kind of flipped from what we are used to hearing when it comes to Legends of Tomorrow. To me, it was just, this is lots and lots and lots of fan service. It had Deathstroke, kind
of. Sort of, yeah.
That was good. I like that. But I really don't know what the point was, other than to put Snart and Heatwave at odds. And that's nice, because it really is their show, but there's not a whole lot else going on that was of importance, let's say. It was a lot of fan service, a lot of name-checking, it seemed.
Yeah, I mean, to my mind, I mean, this it was sort of like I mean, trying to lend the show some of that grittier ambiance from Arrow, if anything, it just helped emphasize and point up how you know at this point Legends of Tomorrow just really does feel like much more of a lightweight in this DCW than Arrow. And even Flash at this point, which you know, yes, is somewhat more upbeat, but has a lot more character depth. Yes, it is still the first season and relatively early in, but after six episodes, there certainly has been time to give it even for a show that you know, yes, maybe sort of more intended to be a little less serious and more fun, but the team not quite coming together yet, and the characters you know, still feeling not really fleshed out is really starting to show at this point.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, it's a little disappointing. I mean, I guess they were due for a bit of a miss when it comes to the success of Berlanti and the DCW type of shows. But this one I thought had a good premise. It had a lot of good characters in it, but it just doesn't seem to be coming together.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Oh, and the fact that I didn't even remember it until now. And this whole love triangle that they're starting to set up was just feeling completely out of, you know, some high school show.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Right down to the let me pretend to look at this panel on the wall.
yes.
But that means that we have concluded our episodic discussion for this week. When we come back next time, we're going to get into some open topics. We don't have any feedback, but we will get into open topics, and we'll see what other things and other goodies come along the way. So until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.